Chapter 11. Jordan had gone out on the side of the building away from the roosting flock. Clay, Tom, Denise, and Dan crossed the room to the midway side. The three men tipped the already vandalized snack machine over on its side and shoved it against the wall. Clay and Dan could see out the high windows easily by standing on it, Tom by standing on tiptoes. Clay added a crate so Denise could also see, praying she wouldn't topple off it and go into labor. They saw Jordan cross to the edge of the sleeping multitude, stand there a minute as if debating, and then move off to his left. Clay thought he continued seeing movement long after his rational mind told him that Jordan must be gone, skirting the edge of the massive flock.
"How long will it take him to get back, do you think?" Tom asked.
Clay shook his head. He didn't know. It depended on so many variables. The size of the flock was only one of them.
"What if they looked in the back of the bus?" Denise asked.
"What if Jordy looks in the back of the bus and there's nothing there?" Dan asked,
and Clay had to restrain himself from telling the man to keep his negative vibe to himself. Time passed, giving itself up by inches. The little red light on the tip of the parachute drop blinked. Paco Bell once more gave way to Foray, and Foray to Vivaldi. Clay found himself remembering the sleeping boy who had come spilling out of the shopping cart, how the man with him, probably not his father, had sat down with him at the side of the road and said, "Gregory, kiss it, make it all better." He remembered the man with the rucksack listening to Baby Elephant Walk and saying, "Dodge had a good time too." He remembered how in the bingo tents of his childhood, the man with the microphone would invariably exclaim, "It's the sunshine vitamin," when he pulled B12 out of the hopper with the dancing ping-pong balls inside, even though the sunshine vitamin was D. The time now gave itself up in what seemed quarter inches, and Clay began losing hope. If they were going to hear the sound of the bus's engine, they should have heard it by now.
"It's gone wrong somehow," Tom said in a low voice.
"Maybe not," Clay said. He tried to keep his heart's heaviness out of his voice.
"No, Tommy's right," Denise said. She was on the verge of tears. "I love him to death, and he was ballsier than Lord Satan on his first night in hell. But if he was coming, he'd be on his way by now."
Dan's take was surprisingly positive.
"We don't know what he might have run into. Just take a deep breath and try to put your imaginations on hold."
Clay tried that and failed. Now the seconds dripped by. Schubert's Ave Maria boomed through the big concert speakers. He thought, "I would sell my soul for some honest rock and roll. Chuck Berry doing O Carol, U2 doing When Love Comes to Town." Outside, nothing but dark and stars and that one tiny, red, battery-driven light.
"Boost me up over there," Tom said, hopping down from the snack machine. "I'll squeeze through that window somehow and see if I can't go get him."
Clay began. "Tom, if I was wrong about there being explosives in the back of the bus..."
"Fuck the back of the bus and fuck the explosives," Tom said, distraught. "I just want to find George."
"Hey," Dan shouted, and then, "Hey, all right, baby now."
He slammed one fist against the wall beside the window. Clay turned and saw headlights had bloomed in the dark. A mist had begun to rise from the blanket of comatose bodies on the acres of mall, and the bus's headlights seemed to be shining through smoke. They flicked bright, then dim, then bright again, and Clay could see Jordan with brilliant clarity, sitting in the driver's seat of the minibus and trying to figure out which controls did which. Now the headlights began to creep forward, high beams.
"Yeah, honey," Denise breathed. "Do it, my sweetheart."
Standing on her crate, she grabbed Dan's hand on one side and Clay's on the other.
"You're beautiful. Just keep on coming."
The headlights jogged away from them, now illuminating the trees far to the left of the open space with its carpet of phoners.
"What's he doing?" Tom almost moaned. "That's where the side of the funhouse takes a jog," Clay said. "It's all right."
He hesitated.
"I think it's all right.
If his foot doesn't slip. If he doesn't mix up the brake and the accelerator, run the bus into the side of the damn funhouse and stick it there." They waited,
and the headlights swung back, spearing the side of Kashwakamak Hall on the dead level. And in the glare of the high beams, Clay saw why it had taken Jordan so long. Not all of the phoners were down. Dozens of them, the ones with bad programming, he assumed, were up and moving. They walked aimlessly toward any and every point of the compass, black silhouettes moving outward in expanding ripples, struggling to make their way over the prone bodies of the sleepers, stumbling, falling, getting up and walking on again, while Schubert's Ave Maria filled the night. One of them, a young man with a long red gash running across the middle of his forehead like a worry line, reached the hall and felt his way along the side like a blind man.
"That's far enough, Jordan," Clay murmured as the headlights neared the speaker standards on the far side of the open area. "Park it and get your ass back here."
It seemed that Jordan heard him. The headlights came to a stop. For a moment, the only things moving out there were the restless shapes of the wakeful phoners and the mist rising from the warm bodies of the others. Then they heard the bus's engine rev. Even over the music, they heard it, and the headlights leaped forward.
"No, Jordan, what are you doing?" Tom screamed.
Denise recoiled and would have tumbled off her crate if Clay hadn't caught her around the waist. The bus jounced into the sleeping flock, onto the sleeping flock. The headlights began to pogo up and down, now pointing at them, now lifting briefly upward, now coming back to dead level again. The bus slewed left, came back on course, then slewed right. For a moment, one of the nightwalkers was illuminated in its four glaring high beams as clearly as something cut from black construction paper. Clay saw the phoner's arms go up as if it wanted to signal a successful field goal, and then it was borne under the bus's charging grill. Jordan drove the bus into the middle of them, and there it stopped, headlights glaring, grill dripping. By raising a hand to block the worst of the shine, Clay was able to see a small dark form, distinguishable from the rest by its agility and purpose, emerge from the side door of the bus and begin making its way toward Kashwakamak Hall. Then Jordan fell, and Clay thought he was gone. A moment later, Dan rapped,
"There he is, there!"
And Clay picked him up again, 10 yards closer and considerably to the left of where he'd lost sight of the kid. Jordan must have crawled for some distance over the sleeping bodies before trying his feet again. When Jordan came back into the hazy cone of radiance thrown by the bus's headlights, tacked to the end of a 40-foot shadow, they could see him clearly for the first time. Not his face, because of the backlighting, but the crazy graceful way he was running over the bodies of the phoners. The ones who were down were still dead to the world. The ones who were awake but not close to Jordan paid no attention. Several of those who were close, however, made grabs at him. Jordan dodged two of these, but the third, a woman, got him by the tangled mop of his hair.
"Let him alone!" Clay roared.
He couldn't see her, but he was insanely positive it was the woman who had once been his wife.
"Let him go!"
She didn't, but Jordan grabbed her wrist, twisted it, went to one knee, and scrambled past. The woman made another grab, just missed the back of his shirt, and then tottered off in her own direction. Many of the infected phoners, Clay saw, were gathering around the bus. The headlights seemed to be drawing them. Clay leaped off the snack machine, this time it was Dan Hartwick who saved Denise from a tumble, and grabbed the crowbar. He leaped back up and smashed out the window he'd been looking through.
"Jordan!" he bawled. "Around back! Get around back!"
Jordan looked up at the sound of Clay's voice and tripped over something, a leg, an arm, maybe a neck. As he was getting back up, a hand came out of the breathing darkness and clutched the kid's throat.
"Please, God, no," Tom whispered.
Jordan lunged forward like a fullback trying for a first down, pistoning with his legs, and broke the hand's grip.
He stumbled onward. Clay could see his staring eyes and the way his chest was heaving. As he neared the hall, Clay could hear Jordan's sobbing gasps for air.
"Never make it," he thought. "Never. And he's so close now. So close."
But Jordan did make it. The two phoners currently staggering along the side of the building showed no interest in him at all as he lunged past them and around to the far side. The four of them were off the snack machine at once and racing across the hall like a relay team, Denise and her belly in the lead. Jordan? She cried, bouncing up and down on her toe tips. Jordan? Jordy? Are you there? For Christ's sake, kid, tell us you're there. I'm... He tore a great gasp of breath out of the air. Here!
Another whooping gasp. Clay was distantly aware of Tom laughing and pounding him on the back.
Never knew... Whoop. Running over people was so... hard.
What did you think you were doing? Clay shouted. It was killing him not to be able to grab the kid, first to embrace him, then shake him, then kiss him all over his stupid, brave face. Killing him to not even be able to see him.
I said get close to them, not drive right the fuck into them. I did it.
Whoop.
For the head.
There was defiance as well as breathlessness in Jordan's voice now.
They killed the head. Them and their raggedy man. Them and their stupid president of Harvard. I wanted to make them pay. I want him to pay.
What took you so long to get going? Denise asked.
We waited and waited. There are dozens of them up and around, Jordan said. Maybe hundreds. Whatever's wrong with them, or right, or just changing, it's spreading really fast now. They're walking every which way, like totally lost. I had to keep changing course. I ended up coming to the bus from halfway down the midway. Then,
he laughed breathlessly,
it wouldn't start. Do you believe it? I turned the key and got nothing but a click every time. I just about freaked, but I wouldn't let myself, because I knew the head would be disappointed if I did that.
Ah, Jordy, Tom breathed.
You know what it was? I had to buckle the stupid seatbelt. You don't need them for the passenger seats, but the bus won't start unless the driver's wearing his. Anyway, I'm sorry it took me so long, but here I am.
And may we assume that the luggage compartment wasn't empty? Dan asked.
You can assume the shit out of that. It's full of what looked like red bricks. Stacks and stacks of them.
Jordan was getting his breath back now.
They're under a blanket. There's a cell phone lying on top of them. Ray attached it to a couple of those bricks with an elastic strap like a bungee cord. The phone's on, and it's the kind with a port, like for a fax or so you can download data to a computer. The power cord runs down into the bricks. I didn't see it, but I bet the detonator's in the middle.
He grabbed another deep breath.
And there were bars on the phone. 3 bars.
Clay nodded. He'd been right. Kashwakamak was supposed to be a cell dead zone once you got beyond the feeder road leading to the Northern Counties Expo. The phoners had plucked that knowledge from the heads of certain normies and had used it. The Kashwak no-fo graffiti had spread like smallpox. But had any of the phoners actually tried making a cell call from the Expo fairgrounds? Of course not. Why would they? When you were telepathic, phones were obsolete. And when you were one member of the flock, one part of the whole, they became doubly obsolete, if such a thing was possible. But cell phones did work within this one small area, and why? Because the carnies were setting up. That was why. Carnies working for an outfit called the New England Amusement Corporation. And in the 21st century, carnies, like rock concert roadies, touring stage productions, and movie crews on location, depended on cell phones, especially in isolated places where landlines were in short supply. Were there no cell phone towers to relay signals onward and upward? Fine. They would pirate the necessary software and install one of their own. Illegal? Of course. But judging by the 3 bars Jordan was reporting, it had been workable. And because it was battery-powered, it was still workable. They had installed it on the Expo's highest point. They had installed it on the tip of the parachute drop. Chapter 12. Dan recrossed the hall, got up on the snack machine, and looked out.
They're 3 deep around the bus, he reported. 4 deep in front of the headlights. It's like they think there's some big pop star hiding inside. The ones they're standing on must be getting crushed.
He turned to Clay and nodded at the dirty Motorola cell phone Clay was now holding.
If you're going to try this, I suggest you try it now, before one of them decides to get in and try driving the damn bus away. I should have turned it off, but I thought the headlights would go out if I did, Jordan said, and I wanted them to see by.
It's okay, Jordan, Clay said. No harm done. I'm going to... But there was nothing in the pocket from which he'd taken the cell phone. The scrap of paper with the telephone number on it was gone.
Chapter 13. Clay and Tom were looking for it on the floor, frantically looking for it on the floor, and Dan was dolefully reporting from atop the snack machine that the first phoner had just stumbled on board the bus when Denise bellowed, "Stop! Shut up!" They all stopped what they were doing and looked at her. Clay's heart was fluttering high in his throat. He couldn't believe his own carelessness. "Ray died for that, you stupid shit," part of him kept shouting at the rest of him. "He died for it, and you lost it." Denise closed her eyes and put her hands together over her bowed head. Then very rapidly she chanted, "Tony, Tony, come around. Something's lost that can't be found." "What the fuck is that?" Dan asked. He sounded astonished. "A prayer to St. Anthony," she said calmly. "I learned it in parochial school. It always works." "Give me a break," Tom almost groaned. She ignored him, focusing all her attention on Clay. "It's not on the floor, is it?" "I don't think so, no." "Another two just got on the bus," Dan reported. "And the turn signals are going, so one of them must be sitting at the..." "Will you please shut up, Dan?" Denise said. She was still looking at Clay, still calm. "And if you lost it on the bus or outside somewhere, it's lost for good, right?" "Yes," he said heavily. "So we know it's not in either of those places."
"Why do we know that?"
"Because God wouldn't let it be." "I think my head's going to explode," Tom said in a strangely calm voice. Again she ignored him. "So which pocket haven't you checked?"
"I checked every..."
Clay began, then stopped. Without taking his eyes from Denise's, he investigated the small watch pocket sewn into the larger right front pocket of his jeans, and the slip of paper was there. He didn't remember putting it there, but it was there. He pulled it out. Scrawled on it in the dead man's laborious printing was the number, 207-919-9811.
"Thanks, St. Anthony, for me," he said. "If this works," she said, "I'll ask St. Anthony to thank God."
"Denny," Tom said. She turned to him. "Thank him for me, too," he said.
Chapter 14. The four of them sat together against the double doors through which they had entered, counting on the steel cores to protect them. Jordan was crouched down in back of the building, below the broken window through which he had escaped.
"What are we going to do if the explosion doesn't blow any holes in the side of this place?" Tom asked.
"We'll think of something," Clay said.
"And if Ray's bomb doesn't go off?" Dan asked.
"Drop back 20 yards and punt," Denise said.
"Go on, Clay. Don't wait for the theme music."
He opened the cell phone, looked at the dark LED readout, and realized he should have checked for bars on this one before sending Jordan out. He hadn't thought of it. None of them had thought of it. Stupid. Almost as stupid as forgetting he'd put the scrap of paper with the number written on it in his watch pocket. He pushed the power button now. The phone beeped. For a moment there was nothing, and then three bars appeared, bright and clear. He punched in the number, then settled his thumb lightly on the button marked call.
"Jordan, you ready back there?"
"Yes."
"What about you guys?" Clay asked.
"Just do it before I have a heart attack," Tom said.
An image rose in Clay's mind, nightmarish in its clarity. Johnny G, lying almost directly beneath the place where the explosives-laden bus had come to rest, lying on his back, with his eyes open and his hands clasped on the chest of his Red Sox t-shirt, listening to the music while his mind rebuilt itself in some strange new way. He swept it aside.
"Tony, Tony, come around," he said for no reason whatever, and then pushed the button that called the cell phone in the back of the minibus.
There was time for him to count Mississippi 1 and Mississippi 2 before the entire world outside Caskwakamak Hall seemed to blow up, the roar swallowing Tommaso Albione's adagio in a hungry blast. All the small windows lining the flock side of the building blew in. Brilliant crimson light shone through the holes, then the entire south end of the building tore away in a hail of boards, glass, and swirling hay. The doors they were leaning against seemed to bend backward. Denise wrapped protective arms around her belly. From outside, a terrible hurt screaming began,
For a moment, this sound ripped through Clay's head like the blade of a buzzsaw. Then it was gone. The screaming in his ears went on. It was the sound of people roasting in hell. Something landed on the roof. It was heavy enough to make the whole building shudder. Clay pulled Denise to her feet. She looked at him wildly, as if no longer sure who he was. "Come on!" he was shouting, but could hardly hear his own voice. It seemed to be seeping through wads of cotton. "Come on, let's get out!" Tom was up. Dan made it halfway, fell back, tried again, and managed it the second time. He grabbed Tom's hand. Tom grabbed Denise's. Linked three across, they shuffled to the gaping hole at the end of the hall. There they found Jordan, standing next to a litter of burning hay, and staring out at what a single phone call had done. Chapter 15. The giant's foot that had seemed to stamp the roof of Kashwakamak Hall had been a large chunk of school bus. The shingles were burning. Directly in front of them, beyond the little pile of blazing hay, were a pair of upside-down seats, also burning. Their steel frames had been shredded into spaghetti. Clothes floated out of the sky like big snow. Shirts, hats, pants, shorts, an athletic supporter, a blazing bra. Clay saw that the hay insulation piled along the bottom of the hall was going to be a moat of fire before very long. They were getting out just in time. Patches of fire dotted the mall area where concerts, outdoor dances, and various competitions had been held, but the chunks of the exploding bus had swept farther than that. Clay saw flames burning high in trees that had to be at least 300 yards away. Dead south of their position, the funhouse had started to burn, and he could see something. He thought it was probably a human torso, blazing halfway up the strutwork of the parachute drop. The flock itself had become a raw meatloaf of dead and dying phoners. Their telepathy had broken down, although little currents of that strange psychic force occasionally tugged at him, making his hair rise and his flesh crawl. But the survivors could still scream, and they filled the night with their cries. Clay would have gone ahead even if he'd been able to imagine how bad it was going to be. Even in the first few seconds, he made no effort to mislead himself on that score. But this was beyond imagining. The firelight was just enough to show them more than they wanted to see. The mutilations and decapitations were bad, the pools of blood, the littered limbs, but the scattered clothes and shoes with nobody inside them were somehow worse, as if the explosion had been fierce enough to actually vaporize part of the flock. A man walked toward them with his hands to his throat in an effort to stem the flow of blood pouring over and between his fingers. It looked orange in the growing glow of the hall's burning roof, while his intestines swung back and forth at the level of his crotch. More wet loops came sliding out as he walked past them, his eyes wide and unseeing. Jordan was saying something. Clay couldn't hear it over the screams, the wails, and the growing crackle of fire from behind him, so he leaned closer.
"We had to do it. It was all we could do," Jordan said.
He looked at a headless woman, a legless man, at something so torn open it had become a flesh canoe filled with blood. Beyond it, two more bus seats lay on a pair of burning women who had died in each other's arms.
"We had to do it. It was all we could do. We had to do it. It was all we could do."
"That's right, honey. Put your face against me and walk like that," Clay said, and Jordan immediately buried his face in Clay's side. Walking that way was uncomfortable, but it could be done. They skirted the edge of the flock's campground, moving toward the back of what would have been a completed midway and amusement arcade if the pulse hadn't intervened. As they went, Kashwakamak Hall burned brighter, casting more light on the mall. Dark shapes, many naked or almost naked, the clothes blown right off them, staggered and shambled. Clay had no idea how many. The few that passed close by their little group showed no interest in them. They either continued on toward the midway area or plunged into the woods west of the expo grounds, where Clay was quite sure they would die of exposure unless they could reestablish some sort of flock consciousness. He didn't think they could, partly because of the virus, but mostly because of Jordan's decision to drive the bus right into the middle of them and achieve a maximum kill zone, as they had with the propane trucks. If they'd ever known snuffing one old man could lead to this, Clay thought. And then he thought, but how could they? They reached the dirt lot where the Carneys had parked their trucks and campers. Here the ground was thick with snaking electrical cables, and the spaces between the campers were filled with the accessories of families who lived on the road. Barbecues, gas grills, lawn chairs, a hammock, a little laundry whirligig with clothes that had probably been hanging there for almost 2 weeks.
"Let's find something with the keys in it and get the hell out of here," Dan said. "They cleared the feeder road, and if we're careful, I bet we can go north on 160 as far as we want."
He pointed.
"Up there, it's just about all no foe."
Clay had spotted a panel truck with Lem's Painting and Plumbing on the back. He tried the doors and they opened. The inside was filled with milk crates, most crammed with various plumbing supplies, but in one he found what he wanted. Paint in spray cans. He took four of these, after checking to make sure they were full, or almost full.
"What are those for?" Tom asked.
"Tell you later," Clay said.
"Let's get out of here, please," Denise said. "I can't stand this. My pants are soaked with blood."
She began to cry. They came onto the midway between the Crazy Cups and a half-constructed kiddie ride called Charlie the Choo-Choo.
"Look," Tom said, pointing.
"Oh, my God," Dan said softly. Lying draped across the peak of the train ride's ticket booth was the remains of a charred and smoking red sweatshirt, the kind sometimes called a hoodie. A large splotch of blood matted the front around a hole probably made by a chunk of flying school bus. Before the blood took over, covering the rest, Clay could make out three letters, the Raggedy Man's last laugh. Har.